Senator Hochschild.
Did you call me up?
Yep. Welcome, Senator.
Thank you. Ready for me?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Today I have for you Senate File 2734. We're really lucky in northern Minnesota to have NRRI as part of the U of M doing incredible research when it comes to our natural resource economy in Minnesota. And one of the opportunities before us that has been advanced at the national level as well is a move that we're trying to make towards green steel. This would make it so that our steel making process and iron pellet extraction industry is clean, right, and carbon free. And so this is really sort of the long-term goal, and NRRI is exactly the kind of organization that is going to help us meet those goals and take the industry to the next level. And so, Mr. Chair, this is a very simple bill. It's an appropriation of $9 million in 2026 and another in 2027 to help with the Natural Resources Research Institute's move towards green steel. And I do have Ralph Weberg with the NRRI to provide any feedback and questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Weberg. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Fateh. My name's Ralph Weberg. I'm the Executive Director at the Natural Resources Research Institute, University of Minnesota. Thank you. We've already had a chance to speak with the committee about 3 weeks ago regarding the state special conversation, so I'm not going to reintroduce NRI because we want to keep things moving along, but I do want to point out that the legislature did create NRI in 1983 with the idea of really driving our ability to use our natural resources in a sustainable manner to drive our economy forward. The portfolio you see on the first page in front of you between the iron minerals of the future, forest industries and bioeconomy, and the ecosystem resilience is that triad that is really attracting attention from across the country and around the world. This portfolio has led to a partnership with seven of the national laboratories across the United States Department of Energy. I spent the last 3 days in D.C. talking about that, and I'm happy to say that we have a lot of support from those laboratories. We've talked about the returns on investment at NRI on the bottom of that first sheet. I can come back and talk about those if you'd like, but we've been instrumental in driving forward in some of the developments at U.S. Steel and the Keetac plant, developing that technology for them as they are building it 20 miles down the street. So what we're talking about today as a Board of Regents priority is investing in the Institute to be able to set us up to be a fantastic partner for the national labs that carry out this huge endeavor of moving our base industries into the future in a competitive way. And you see in the first upper part, what we're talking about is what we're calling the MITI initiative, the Midwest Industrial Transformation Initiative, that really starts with green iron and green steel as the flywheel to drive through other major parts of our economy, both in our state and region and across the country. You can see the points that we're driving is really driving U.S. energy use and market-driven energy choices, grid reliability, globally competitive industries, which is where really we're focusing. And of course, when we start talking about steel, it's got to be part of the national security conversation as well. What we're building is an industrial ecosystem that uses values and creates stewardship for our natural ecosystems. And when you look at that little map on the right, Minnesota has it all. And I remind you again that that map's sitting at DOE headquarters in DC today. So what we're asking, if that's the opportunity, the challenge is NRI and Minnesota prepared to stand up to this challenge? And the answer is not quite, because our facilities are very antiquated and we need to be able to have the facilities and capabilities and the people to be able to onboard cutting-edge technology to bring it here in the state, demonstrate that big picture for the country. That's the vision that the Department of Energy is asking Minnesota to stand up to. So we're asking for this infusion as a second investment since 1983 to take NRI to the next step where we can engage and specifically build those partnerships with the national labs and everyone else engaged with the industry and the communities, drive federal investment into Minnesota and the Midwest, expand a national laboratory presence in Minnesota, which we deserve, and also really drive our communities and our competitive industries. The money we're going to be using is to basically hire the key skill sets we need in order to be able to engage the national laboratory on an even scale, provide the facilities that we can have. We're right now installing $3 and $4 million piece of equipment in a 1905 building. There's issues with that, and everything from safety and code to effectiveness and cutting edge. So we're asking for this money because we want to be competitive with other states. We want to be able to do the best job for Minnesota and for the country. I'll stop there.
Thank you so much, Mr. Weberg. And for the record, a quorum is present. We have members online as well. Any questions from members? Seeing none, any closing comments, Senator? Oh, sorry, Senator Utke. I'm sorry.
Yeah, not a problem. You know, you talk about the green steel.
Yep.
At first I thought you were partnering up with John Deere, but the steel industry is unique. You're just looking at where you're sourcing the power from, the electricity, I would guess, right? That's pretty much the biggest thing you can do. I mean, it takes equipment, it takes power to do these things.
Senator Hostetler, Mr. Weber.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senator Utke, that's correct to an extent. I believe, though, however, the steelmaking process also has components that would, you know, move towards greener technology as well. But I'll let the expert speak to that.
Dr. Weberg.
Sure. Thank you. Senator Utke, you're absolutely right. These industries we're talking about are massive users of energy. If you think about the level of the energy use for one of our taconite plants, it's about 500 megawatts. That would run Minneapolis. And so when we're trying to move into a green conversation where we're using, in this case, renewable sources of electricity, but we're moving into market-driven sources of electricity that would generate hydrogen to replace carbon, fossil carbon, in this process. So when you take a piece of iron oxide, which is what we mine today, rust, and we want to convert that into metallic iron, we can use hydrogen to do that instead of carbon. When you use carbon, it loves oxygen, but it creates carbon dioxide, and the industry needs to be going to the green iron and then green steel, which utilizes, again, non-fossil carbon and hydrogen to do the work. So is green iron and green steel just something that people like to do? No, it's now a global expectation that when you're selling into that global steel industry that you have an answer for green steel. Volvo just announced that their entire line is going to be made with green steel. Ford and GM are now considering it. It's table stakes to have what's called a life cycle assessment for the products you want to sell globally. It's the same for cement. It's the same for a lot of other materials. And if we're going to be offering competitive materials into that market, we have to be getting on board now. So green steel isn't a color. It's how you use your energy, where you get it, how you convert it into hydrogen, and what carbon sources you use.
Thank you. Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it basically, all those processes start at the beginning with electricity. So having a nuclear power plant up there would be the first major step for you, right? But that's a whole nother topic. We're in higher ed today. But thank you much.
Thank you so much, Senator Utke. Any other members? Senator Hostetler for closing comments.
No, I just appreciate the consideration, Mr. Chair. This is a really critical industry, and moving towards a carbon future is important to me as well. So hopefully we can keep moving forward on this type of thing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Senator Hostetler. And with that, Senate File 2734 will be laid over. Next up, we have Senate File 2881. Again, Senator Hostetler, you may begin your testimony with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you said, today I also have Senate File 2881, and I want to thank Senator Rarick for joining me on this bill. Currently, the annual income from the Permanent University Fund is distributed to the principal of three PUF endowment funds based upon the following formula. 25% to the endowed mineral research account, which is capped at $50 million. 25% to the endowed Mesabi Range account, which is capped at $25 million principal, and the remainder 50% to endowed scholarship account. In fiscal year 2012, the endowed mineral research account reached its $50 million principal cap. Since then, no new income from PUF lands has been added to the mineral research account. So the distribution of PUF income has actually been 0% to the endowed mineral research account, 25% to the endowed Mesabi Range account, and the remainder 75% to the endowed scholarship account. The vast majority, 70% of earnings above principal in the endowed scholarship account, are distributed to scholarships to students in the Twin Cities campus. The proposal above would alter the formula to allow the NRRI to leverage more funding from PUF income. In addition to growing the principal of the endowed mineral research account, it would allow the NRRI to begin spending an amount of annual PUF income as immediate revenue. The new distribution would be 25% directed appropriation to the NRRI, 25% to the endowed mineral research account, 25% to the endowed Mesabi Range account, and the remainder 25% to the endowed scholarship account. The new formula would lift the cap on that mineral research account to allow principal to grow again. It would also allow NRRI to receive a portion of annual PUF income as a direct appropriation from which would be immediately available for expenditure. The distribution to the endowed Mesabi Range account would remain untouched, and the distribution to the endowed scholarship account would be reduced, causing the principal to grow at a slower rate. With that, Mr. Chair, I have Mr. Weberg here again to go into further detail as needed and here for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator. Dr. Weberg.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Right now, the NRI receives about $4 million a year, give or take, depending on market conditions, out of the current endowment fund. Unlike other facilities at the University of Minnesota, NRI pays all expenses for the Coleraine site. It's a former 27-acre U.S. steel production site that we run. So that means we pay the lights, the heat, even the snow shoveling, as well as a group of operators that we have to keep on staff to be able to turn around and work with the industry as they need it. That's just barely covering that. And this is a nice way to be able to access more funding, to be able to grow, as I said in my first testimony. And I very much appreciate the support of Senator Housechild as well as Senator Rarick and the staff in coming up with this approach to doing this, because we're well aware of the general fund conversations. So I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Dr. Weberg. Are there any questions or comments from members? Seeing none, any closing comments? Senator Housechild.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Sam for his particular effort on this, as well as the U of M for the conversations on this bill. And I'm sure those conversations will be ongoing as we continue through the process. So appreciate the opportunity to present the bill.
Thank you, Senator. And with that, Senate File 2881 will be laid over. Thank you. Next up, we got Senate File 2703, Senator Gustafson. Welcome.
Sorry. Chairs don't move. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate File 2703 creates an enrollment fraud working group to address a growing issue in higher education. It's called Ghost Student Fraud, where bad actors create fake student enrollments using bots or stolen identities in a new post-pandemic threat to our higher education institutions. The fraud aims to exploit financial aid and EDU email access, which then can be abused for further criminal activities. So this issue, which places a significant strain on institutions, was first uncovered by two-year colleges. While some schools like Century College in my district have implemented internal solutions, many lack the resources for dedicated fraud prevention. This creates a patchwork of varied responses across the state, leaving our higher education system vulnerable. So far, the state has taken the first step to develop a system-wide approach by convening IT experts to develop best practices. This bill builds upon that important work by bringing faculty and admission staff to the table, forming an enrollment fraud working group. Additionally, it requires the working group to submit a report to the legislature on potential paths forward. Senate File 2703 develops a unified statewide strategy that proactively protects our higher education system from this emerging threat. This will prevent Minnesota from becoming a target for fraudsters seeking to exploit our higher education resources. I do have some testifiers, Mr. Chair, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, yes. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Senator and committee members. My name is Joe Haker. I've been a history instructor at Century College for 8 years, and I'm here to speak about the problem of ghost students. I started to encounter this problem in the summer of 2023 when I figured out that 15% of my students were actually the same person or group of people using assumed names, basically an organized crime ring. The problem has worsened from there in our fully online asynchronous courses. Century has taken this very seriously. We are devoting, as far as I know, 4 full-time employees to preventing these people from reaching our classrooms. Given the circumstances, they really have done a great job, but they are still overwhelmed by the scope of the problem, which evolves faster than they can respond. So we do still end up with fake students in our classes, and sometimes that is in large numbers. This fall, a colleague of mine found that 30 of her 60 students in online courses were ghosts. She did prevent every single one of them from receiving financial aid, but this involved a lot of work, and 30 seats were wasted on ghost students. When this happens, it is a ton of additional work for instructors, which distracts from our jobs and the real students who deserve better. It means less time for lesson planning, commenting, discussion facilitation, and all of our other daily work. Sometimes the fraud is blatant and obvious, but a lot of people who actually manage to get into our classes now have become more sophisticated. I have never seen a ghost student turn in good work, but more and more of it is plausible work, by which I mean it looks like something a real student might submit if they were confused or struggling or perhaps using AI themselves. We have a lot of those students in community colleges, and so the last thing that you want to do is confuse a real person who is trying and struggling with a criminal. So even if you are fairly confident that you're encountering fraud, you're often not positive. Even if you are convinced, it might not be actionable. If they are regularly submitting work, and if you don't have definitive proof of fraud, your options as an instructor are limited. So you spend a ton of time trying to figure out if your students are even real, while trying not to create unnecessary roadblocks for the students who are. And in the meantime, you are then involving financial aid and records and other staff members who are now being drawn away from the functioning of the school. So it's a huge waste of manpower. One of my concerns is how this affects the quality of our courses and our relationship with online students. You can't help but feel besieged. Some ghost students are really aggressive. Others try to manipulate you with sob stories. Both are playing on your emotions, hoping that you withdraw them. But you do not withdraw them before the deadline. But now you start every semester with a suspicious approach to students. And because a good online course requires significant student-to-student interaction, ghost students make that experience much worse as well. Faculty have taken this very seriously at Century. It is a constant topic of discussion, planning, and anxiety. We know that if these people are still enrolled by the second week, they will get their money. The school is on the hook. Taxpayers are on the hook. Whoever has had their identity stolen is on the hook. And after that second week, many students disappear. Some continue to take the class. They are not trying to pass. They just want to take an F and continue to use the same identity until they're put on academic suspension. So given the scope of the problem, I think we've done a surprisingly good job preventing it from being worse than it could be. But I do know that the problem cannot be addressed fully by faculty or individual institutions, because if it could be, it already would have been at Century, which is, I think, doing more than any other school that I'm aware of. We just lack the training and the time and the tools to root out all of the fraud that we encounter. So I really believe this has to be a comprehensive, systematic, statewide approach. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up, we have Jenna Chernega, the president from the Inter-Faculty Organization. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Chair Fata, my name is Jennifer Chernega, and I'm the president of the IFO, or Inter-Faculty Organization. We're the union that represents the teaching faculty, coaches, counselors, and librarians in the 7 Minnesota State Universities. Thank you for the opportunity to speak here today. The committee has heard me testify last year about the need to be good stewards of taxpayer dollars when corporations seek to profit off of student aid programs at the expense of our institutions. However, you've also heard today that we are facing the need to be good stewards of tax and tuition dollars when bots and AI are deployed to engage in financial aid fraud. We're thankful this important proposal is before you today. Although we don't have a clear sense of the size of these scams in Minnesota State, it's clear that faculty, staff, and administrations throughout the system understand the risks with this new phenomena. Faculty and staff have thus far been on the front lines in combating this fraud. As the scam evolves, it's clear we'll need robust planning and coordination to ensure we stop these bad actors before they drain our precious resources. We're grateful that Senator Gustafson has brought the idea forward to require an inclusive working group and processes so that everyone is working under the same plan to attack this problem. And we're ready to partner with the system and campus administrations and our labor partners to ensure safeguards are developed that protect taxpayer dollars, students, faculty and staff, institutions, and access to the affordable higher education that Minnesotans rely on. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Before we go on to our next speaker, I think Senator Rarick has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And try to get an understanding of how this is working. You're saying they're maybe stealing someone else's identity. Is that person getting the bill from the school but yet the student aid is actually going to this other person? And then is the school, when they realize that, are they acknowledging it and not billing the other person? Is just trying to get an understanding of how this is happening and how they're benefiting.
Yes, we're going to have Mr. Haker.
Thank you for your question. That is my understanding, that a lot of the names that we are getting are stolen identities. Those people then sometimes come to the school and say, we have never taken out student loans. Where is this coming from? And then the school works with them to try to make sure that they don't have to pay it. But then the school, my understanding is, on the hook for the money.
Senator Eric.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Not sure if you're exactly the person to ask this question of, but you know, when we hear about all these cybersecurity concerns that are out there, would this be one that you're kind of ranking as your top, or what would be maybe some of your top four or five concerns around cybersecurity? And so where does this rank in your area of concerns?
So Senator Eric, I think our next testifier will be an expert on that. So could we have them testify? Okay, thank you so much. Awesome. I'm going to have the next testifier come up, Mr. Craig Munson. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I am Craig Munson, Chief Information Security Officer for Minnesota State Colleges and Universities. I oversee the security safeguards for the large technology systems that are used by over 270,000 students, 14,000 faculty and staff. I wanted to thank Senator Gustafson for her interest in enrollment fraud. We appreciate the legislative interest, as this is something we take very seriously at Minnesota State. And I did hear testimony about what is a ghost student, and typically ghost students are primarily, you know, fake identities created by fraudsters to take advantage of the student application system at our educational institutions in the hope of stealing government aid and other technology services. They even use this process to gain access to free student software licenses. And why are we seeing this more over the past years? In a previous testimony, they touched on that. You know, ghost students have existed for quite some time in higher education. This is not a new phenomenon. You know, ever since the pandemic compelled many higher educational institutions to offer those more online classes, you know, this type of enrollment fraud is on the rise. Colleges and universities across the nation have quickly become a primary target for fraudsters who believe that both public and private school systems tend to be much slower in adopting cybersecurity defenses. So what are our risks at Minnesota State? You know, the fraudsters conduct these attacks at scale, often attempting to enroll hundreds or thousands of fake students at once. If these fake students are created by attackers with bot-powered tools using stolen or fake identities, and if they manage to get enrolled, they then apply for the Pell Grants and other federal college subsidies. Stealing money was intended for real students in need of financial aid. Attackers also try to gain access to services, including software such as Microsoft Office. They try to gain access to our learning management systems and email systems, creating more phishing attacks or advertising for homework completion services. With the influx in the awareness and the use of artificial intelligence, or AI, the fraudsters have access to sophisticated technology tools that can assist them with their fraudulent activities. I'd like to note that we also leverage AI in our detection systems. So how are we protecting ourselves? It should be noted that this phenomenon will never be 100% remediated as fraudsters develop more sophisticated tactics and attacks as time goes by. What we focus on is risk mitigation. Minnesota State has been adapting to these attacks for several years now. Over the past year, a cross-functional team has been meeting, and we are largely doing the things highlighted in this bill. In this team, we are working with our partners in academic and student affairs and their subject matter experts to standardize and enhance our safeguards. Some of these safeguards are time-intensive to conduct, with staff members reviewing student applications and validating that this is a real person. Sometimes additional identity proofing steps are required. And again, identity proofing is a security measure used to verify and authenticate an individual's identity. We are also looking at utilizing the validation tools provided by Workday as we implement our new student information system. I'd like to mention that there are some off-the-shelf solutions. However, these are automated services, but they're not well suited for our student environment, as many of the vetting systems are mainly used for people who have established credit profiles. Their accuracy degrades for people under 25 years of age, even more so for students under 21. And for our PSEO students, who mostly are largely under 18, this is quite ineffective. It is important to note that some identity proofing safeguards can be quite cumbersome to our student applicants. Our cybersecurity and academic teams are working together to ensure that we do not create equity gaps with our remediation tools, but at the same time, these tools effectively mitigate the attacks. As a system of public higher education who is open to all, we need to maintain a balance between accessibility and fraud protections. So this bill requires student representation as well as faculty and MAPE representation as part of an enrollment fraud working group. Given MAPE's involvement in IT and cybersecurity work, we currently have MAPE representation on this cross-functional team that I mentioned earlier. We can certainly add students and faculty representation to this team as well. And also, I wanted to refer, a senator asked about what were the things that may have kept me up at night. I would say that, you know, the top things that I'm mostly concerned about is phishing attacks. We have that on a daily basis. Ransomware attacks, we always want to prepare for, as those are most destructive to our environment. And then I'd like to mention about the general cybersecurity attacks that we get from any nation states. That we do need to protect ourselves well, and the enrollment fraud. I think that those are the top four things that we focus our time and effort and energy on. And thank you for the opportunity to provide some testimony today.
Thank you so much, Senator Rarick.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so when you are finding, and maybe you said some of these groups, they're trying to maybe get 100 or these fake students. Who are you working with to maybe try to turn over some of this evidence so that the state can be attempting to get some of this money back or to catch the folks to press charges? Is it local? Is it state? Who might you be partnering with to try to go after these folks?
Mr. Munn.
Thank you, Chair. Senator, I would say yes, many different groups. There are some that we use our three-letter acronyms in the federal government that we have close ties with. We also work with what we call ISIC groups. They are specialized for research and educational networks, which is us folks that, and we also have our multi-state or MS-ISAC that we also work with, and they provide us threat intel on a regular basis. And we can also reach out to like FBI and other federal agencies to help us in those, and they often do. Do we catch people? Sometimes. It's not too often. Sometimes the cost of of finding someone that took us for, let's say, $3,000. It might take $20,000, $30,000, $50,000 of work to do that, but we do catch them from time to time.
Thank you, Senator Eric. Mr. Munson, are you finding that perpetrators are usually within Minnesota, out of state, or international?
Thank you, Chair. I would say that they are a mixture. There are many, I would say, attacks from outside of the United States, and there is some, I would say, a little bit of local because they know our systems and they've gone to our and taken our classes before, but there are large groups that do this, you know, they specialize in their cyber crime, and this is one specialty that they do engage in, and they are not from the United States, and they're from other nation states.
Thank you so much, Mr. Munson. Any other questions from members? Senator Utke.
Yeah, I guess I never knew this went on. So it's kind of an eye-opening thing, but when you're looking at who you're going to bring together, is it going to be all guys like the gentleman to your right? I mean, the IT people are the people with the expertise in this right now, and you know, it's. And I guess I did have a question as we were kind of listening. A lot of these enrollments, are these enrollments that are just being initiated online, or are some even coming in person and using fake identification and that sort of thing?
Mr. Munson?
Thank you, Senator Utke. Most of them are online applications. We've even seen cases where they even attempt to create an online presence or an identity to move forward. Hopefully that answers your question in that space.
Senator Utke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just a little bit of a follow-up. You know, as you were talking about, I mean, because they're accessing the financial aid and stuff, trying to scam this money, using some of the same techniques as the banking industry would use today to make sure that there is the proper identity. I mean, is it something where we can make them just, I mean, the initial application has to be in person or any of that to help you out? Because, I mean, if it's all just online, it's somebody with a computer that's much smarter than I am sitting there pulling in the money.
Mr. Munson.
Thank you, Senator Utke. Yes, in a similar way, we are like banks, and our protections are similar to banks as well. Some people can also apply online for a line of credit or for opening up an account. So we need to have protections both as people physically come in, but also online. And so we need to consider both cases, and we have different processes to handle both of those cases and even early alert systems. So if an attacker is known to be fraudulent, it's not just telling, for instance, Sentry that this is a suspect or we should flag this application, but let all 33 colleges and universities know about that as well.
Okay.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Clark.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Senator Gustafson, for bringing this bill forward. In my other job, this is part of what I do. Not this particular fraud detection, but in my role as ethics and compliance officer, it is figuring out what you need to do and then dive in and go. So I appreciate this starting point, and this is when we were identifying a new issue like this is, you've got to put together the experts and get into it. So thank you for identifying that. First, we have to, it's not just admiring the problem, it's identifying and scoping the problem. So this is the right first clear step. I would encourage you, I'm guessing we're not the only ones, I'm sure, so advice to the working group or those that are already working on it. What do we have outside of Minnesota? Where else are we seeing this? Let's do some benchmarking and pull from what we can do. Perhaps they've got some ingenious solutions already that we can put in place that you're already doing, or they're already doing. But this is the right step for addressing a clear fraud. And so thank you for getting this going. Let's go. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Senator Clark. Are there any other members? Seeing none, any closing comments, Senator Gustafson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your time. I think Senator Utke had a good question about who was on the bill. 1.14 lists who could be in the working group, but listening to Senator Clark talk about it as well, it does say on 1.21 that others deemed necessary by the working group, it might be good to have some legislative representation so that that could maybe drive some policy decisions. So I think you've signed yourself up for a task group, if you would like. I'll put your name forward if that's what you would like. Thank you.
Senator Gustafson offers the A2 to add Utke to.
No.
Thank you, Senator. With that, the bill is laid over. Senate file 2703 is laid over.
Thank you.
That's good. And then, next up is Senate file 2932. Senator Umu Verbane. Welcome, Senator Umu Verbane. I understand you have the A1 amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. It's an author's amendment. We'd love to move that.
Senator Umu Verbane moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Umu Verbane.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate file 2932 is the standardized aid offers bill. It's really about transparency and consistency and accessibility in student financial aid. Understanding financial aid is one of the biggest challenges for students and families navigating higher education. And what this bill does is it instructs OHE to work with a group of stakeholders to develop a standardized set of standardized financial aid forms so that students can receive clear, consistent, and comparable information across institutions. I want to talk just a little bit about why this is necessary and then how this bill kind of came into formation. But Minnesotans are, burdened by student debt. There's a number of Minnesotans dealing with that, myself included, and that has long-term consequences from negatively affecting credit scores to delaying major life milestones, just having financial and emotional strain, and thinking about a number of, this is not everyone, but a number of young people who are making some of these decisions as they're figuring out where to go to school and maybe not understanding the full consequences at that time. I think this is a really important consumer protection measure to make sure they are able to really compare offers across institutions and have a clear understanding of this is exactly what I'm going to need to pay and what that net price will be, which I'll go into in a little bit more detail here. But this comes out of the Government Accountability Office's report that they did on financial aid offers and action needed to improve information on college costs and student aid. That came out in 2022. You have a copy of that in your packets. First and foremost, the report did recommend legislation requiring colleges to provide students financial aid offers that follow these best practices and provide clear standard information. I did want to highlight a few findings from the report. Most colleges are not following those best practices for providing clear and standard information in their financial aid offers. Nearly two-thirds of colleges follow half or fewer of the 10 best practices. And then an estimated 91% of colleges do not include or they understate the net price in their aid offers, which can really leave students guessing how much they will need to pay. When I talk about net price, by the way, that is really, that's the actual amount that a student will need to pay to attend. So that's estimated by subtracting the gift aid that they receive. So that's, not loans or work study, but really grants, scholarships from the full cost of attendance. And then the full cost of attendance includes some key direct and indirect costs. And so that's how you calculate that and understand, you know, what any out-of-pocket costs would be for a student and their families. So that was what was found in the report. And I think what this bill does is really align with the recommendations of the report, and I'll go through some ways that it does that. First, it emphasizes, the GAO report emphasizes the need for clear and standardized information financial aid offers, and of course, this bill is instructing OHE to develop those standardized financial aid offer forms. It also highlights the importance of involving stakeholders in the process. And this bill does list out a number of stakeholders that OHE needs to collaborate with to develop the form. So the student loan advocate in the Department of Commerce, students, higher education institutions, financial aid administrators and counselors, school counselors, and then just any other stakeholders that the commissioner may determine. The GAO also found that most colleges do not provide, you know, clear or standard information in their financial aid offers, and so really making sure that this form is developed and then is able to be used starting with the 2028-2029 academic school year would address that. As I mentioned, net price before, that is really important, and the GAO report talked about that a lot, that students really need to understand the net price and that most of these offers are not either including that or sort of understating what the net price is. So that is one of the requirements that you'll see in the bill. And then lastly, I mentioned that there was the recommendation for legislative action in the GAO report. There is a bipartisan bill at the federal level to standardize financial aid offer forms. It is the Understanding the True Cost of College Act, sponsored by Senators Chuck Grassley, Tina Smith, and Joni Ernst. But I think we have an opportunity here to make sure that we are really leading the way in Minnesota, and so that's what the bill does. Just going to give you a little bit more detail about the different sections in the bill and before going to some of the testifiers. So again, Section 1 is really the process around consulting the stakeholders. Section 2 is where you'll see an outline of the required contents of the form, essentially. So that starts with subdivision 2, that's the cost information. When I talk about direct costs, that's like tuition and fees, or college or university sponsored, like housing, food costs. And then indirect costs can be estimated housing and food costs for students who are off campus, could be cost of books, materials, supplies, transportation, health insurance. Subdivision 3 requires information on grants and scholarships. So that's like the pure gift aid that a student wouldn't have to pay back. And then subdivision 4 references the net price that I've been talking about. So that's cost minus gift aid. Subdivision 5 requires some information on loans, which are, you know, again, often included in these packets, but or in these offers, but that is money you will have to pay back. And then subdivision 6, just keep in mind there's the changes from the amendment, but that's supplemental information on cost of attendance. So you can get cost of attendance adjustments depending on your situation. To give you an example, a student with a disability may have like higher housing costs, and so they could request for that to be an adjustment to their cost of attendance and then potentially lead to receiving more aid. The new subdivision 7 then is supplemental information for students with dependents. And so that is just requiring information about how to request a dependent care allowance. Again, a thing that's for, you know, students who have dependents, they may have to pay for childcare. And so then that can be accounted for in cost of attendance, which may result in more aid. And then it also requires institutions to provide information about Minnesota's child care grant program. Subdivision 8 is just around the process to accept or decline offers. And then Section 3 is the information about how to pay this back, so repayment resources like private student loans or work study. And then lastly, the bill just clarifies that this doesn't prohibit schools from providing, you know, supplemental information, and that if there were federal legislation, that would supersede this bill. So I've been working with the institutions to gather their feedback. A lot of that's already been incorporated into this bill, but that's an ongoing process, and continuing to have conversations with them about this. And again, really think it's important that this bill does outline a stakeholder process that will involve them as well in developing the form. This is not the first time we've had legislation like this. I do want to thank Senator Dreheim, who authored a standardized offer letter bill back in 2017. That was kind of the first version, at least that I'm aware of. And he's also agreed to sign on as a co-author of this bill. So with that, I will just say that I think this is really important for our students to be able to compare offers, to make informed decisions, you know, plan responsibly, invest in their futures with confidence. Hope to earn everyone's support, and I'm looking forward to hearing the testimony.
Thank you so much, Senator. First on the list of testifiers, we have Rachel Fishman on Zoom, who is a higher education program director, New America. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me. My name is Rachel Fishman, and I am the director of the higher education program at New America. We at the higher education program believe in a higher education system that is accessible, affordable, equitable, and accountable for helping students lead fulfilling and economically secure lives. And that vision is why I'm here today to support the College Financing Literacy Act that's before the committee. The bill would require all colleges and universities that accept state grant aid to provide students with a standard financial aid offer so they can easily and rapidly compare their financial aid offers and decide which institution is going to be the best financial fit for their situation. I'm a consumer advocate at heart, and at New America, I've been advocating for college cost and financial aid transparency for over a decade. I've been researching and publishing on this topic and have been pushing for federal reform. That body of work that I've helped establish has informed a common sense bipartisan and bicameral federal solution in Congress that's been mentioned. This is the Understanding the True Cost of College Act, which Minnesota Senator Smith is already a lead co-sponsor of. For most people, the price of college is only exceeded by buying a house. Many complicated financial transactions already require common and comparable disclosures. So if you think about car window stickers when you're trying to buy a car, ensuring that you know exactly how much your certain make or model is going to compare on the lot to another make or model. Your mortgage closing disclosures, which bank is going to give you the best deal on some of the fees within your mortgage. The summary of benefits and coverage for health insurance, which plan is really going to be the best plan for my situation in terms of value. And credit card statement requirements, which really show you standardized across the board how long it's going to take you to pay down your balance. Yet even though paying for college is this enormous financial decision, students are left in the dark when it comes to being able to understand the price they will pay and how financial aid will apply. I've seen just how confusing this can be for students and families to navigate. Prior to my life in policy, I worked as a counselor helping low-income students navigate offers. Because institutions provide their own formatting of offers, decide what and what not to include, use different terminology across the board, it was impossible to directly compare these offers. For example, some offers would use loans and not even call them loans and make it seem like the student was getting a full ride. Found this very, very misleading. Once I came to New America, I was able to partner with another direct service organization, U Aspire, to source and analyze thousands of financial aid offers. We found in 2018 that these important communications to students are nearly impossible to comprehend and impossible to compare. Over a third of colleges had no information on their financial aid offers about costs at all. There were 136 different terms for a common federal student loan. 24 colleges and universities were not even calling it a loan. over 7 in 10 groups, over 7 in 10 colleges group all types of aid together in one lump sum without adequately really explaining that something like work study won't be available to defray your cost up front. Our research did achieve really important traction that we saw. The U.S. Department of Education provided guidance to financial aid administrators stipulating price and financial aid transparency. The Membership Organization of Financial Aid Administrators, known as NASFA, reminded members to adhere to a code of conduct relating to their financial aid offers. And after all this guidance happened, Representative Virginia Fox, who's a Republican from North Carolina, requested the government accountability report that you heard about. And that report found that despite this guidance issued by the Department of Education and by NASFA, nothing had changed with financial aid offers. They were just as confusing as they were before that guidance. Colleges and universities were quick to act to mitigate this damaging news from the GAO. They started the College Cost Transparency Initiative. That is a voluntary effort to get institutions to conform to basic minimum standards. But with history as our guide, it is clear that any voluntary effort will not suffice. Only the institutions with the best of intentions will sign up, letting institutions with predatory recruitment efforts off the hook. Not to mention, by only adopting minimum standards, there would be no common formatting that would allow for students to make quick apples-to-apples comparisons in pricing and aid among all of their options, their schooling options. So it's clear that government intervention is needed, which is what the GAO has called for, and which is why we have seen such bipartisan and bicameral traction at the federal level of Understanding the True Cost of College Act. Unfortunately, as you all know, it's very challenging here in D.C., where I'm situated, to get anything done through Congress these days, which is why it's important for Minnesota lawmakers to act. Minnesota has the opportunity to become a real vanguard when it comes to providing its citizens with clear and comparable college cost and financial aid information. I applaud this effort on behalf of all those students I helped to navigate this opaque process, and I will remain in case there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Our next testifier is Eddie Conroy, Higher Education Policy Manager for New America. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Good afternoon. My name is Dr. Edward Conroy, and I'm a Senior Policy Manager also at New America with Rachel. And like her, I'm here to speak in support of the College Financing Literacy Act for the committee. I've been really fortunate to spend more than a decade working to support students and improvements in higher education in direct service research and now policy-focused roles. But the job that launched me into higher education was working as a financial aid administrator for the first 6 years of my career, with 5 of those spent at UCLA, where I ran outreach and communications for the financial aid office. In that role, I spent most of my time figuring out how to effectively communicate with students and their families about financial aid, the cost of college, and ensuring that incoming students were as well informed about their choices to pay for college as possible. Financial aid is a really complicated issue, and communicating about it effectively is a challenge for all colleges, which is why I understand that financial aid offices often have their work cut out for them. That understanding of how hard it is to effectively communicate about financial aid is why I support a single user-tested and easily comparable aid offer that all Minnesota colleges accepting state grant aid will have to use. This position is one that unfortunately often puts me at odds with friends and former colleagues who still work in financial aid offices around the country. And I have enormous respect for financial aid administrators. They have immensely hard jobs. But on this issue, the financial aid community and the associations that represent the interests of colleges and universities have been consistently wrong. NASFA, the National Association of Financial Aid Administrators, and other higher education associations have consistently opposed a standard financial aid offer. The unfortunate reality is that higher education associations represent the interests of colleges and universities, not the interests of students. Sometimes those interests overlap, but often they do not. What is best for colleges is not always what is in the best interests of the students and families trying to figure out how they will pay for that college education. A standard form will remove any incentive for colleges to use their financial aid offers as a marketing tool, which is all too often the case. As some of the, as financial aid offices and institutions have frequently argued, colleges and universities compete to enroll students regionally, internationally, and they consider their aid offers to be part of their enrollment marketing. That reality means that aid offers and financial aid offices are attempting to properly inform students about college costs, grants, and loans to help them make a huge financial decision in the same document they are using as a tool to persuade students to enroll. Those goals will always be in tension with each other. And those goals also mean that colleges are understandably reluctant, as Rachel mentioned, to adopt voluntary standards, which is why a legislative solution is necessary. Students need accurate information about every part of paying for college, not just the pieces they will pay directly to their institution, like tuition and on-campus housing. The college-going population is more diverse today than it has ever been. An ever-growing number of students are older when they enroll. One in five had children, and many are veterans. In fact, more than half of college students are now considered non-traditional in one way or another. The wonderful part of this bill is that it will ensure students get accurate information not only about their direct costs, but also the indirect costs like housing and food expenses that they will have to cover. The reality for most students is that their non-tuition expenses are now greater than tuition and fees. And so students need to understand that full picture of costs, not just the part that they will be charged directly by their institution. These expenses, particularly non-tuition expenses, are really vital for students when weighing their net price, especially since many students help to borrow to help cover their non-tuition expenses. Also of vital importance for students who may be moving when they attend college and coming from a lower cost of living area into one that is higher cost of living and may not realize or understand if they don't get accurate information that their housing, food, and other living costs could be significantly different from what they are used to. Minnesota really has the opportunity to become a leader on this issue with transparent financial aid offers by passing the College Financing Literacy Act and act as an example to other states. Ultimately, this becomes a question of whether we should put students first or institutions first, and I encourage the committee to put students first. Thank you so much for your time. I'll also remain if there are any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Maxwell Berg from the University of Minnesota. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record, and you may begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Max Berg, and I'm a freshman from the University of Minnesota and a first-generation college student from my family farm in Carver County. And just yesterday, I paid off the last of my tuition for this academic year and found that I am heading into my summer break with less than $100 to my name, which isn't great finances to live it up in your first summer after college. And that is not due to a lack of hard work by my parents or by me. I'm a farm boy. Hard work was what I got to do for fun back home. You're not allowed to be bored when you have chores to do. The financial strain is not because of poor planning or lack of effort. It was caused by a lack of clarity and transparency in my financial aid offer letter. I believe that I had received a full ride scholarship, but that full ride depended on my ability to find a job on campus to access my work study funds, something I did not realize until halfway through my fall semester when I received a bill for $1,800. And again in the spring. I wasn't financially prepared because I was misled by an offer that wasn't written in language that someone like me could easily comprehend and understand. I am privileged to have such a small bill to pay out of pocket compared to some of my peers, but I am not privileged enough to come from a family that can afford to financially support me. I am building a bridge to my future on my own and paying the price for it literally. But that price should not have me considering homelessness a reasonable trade-off to stay in school. I'm a first-generation college student with three younger siblings back home, and I'm graduated from a small country high school where a lot of kids still look up to me. My success doesn't just determine my future, it shapes theirs. I'm blazing a path and fighting through all the challenges so that they have a path to follow and it's easier for them. And that is not a responsibility I shy away from. I'm proud of it. And I'll pay any price to succeed for them, for my community, and for me. So when students like me come before you and ask you to support this bill and bills like it, we're not asking you to carry the weight for us. That is the challenge we accepted a long time ago. All we're asking for is honesty. Tell us what it's really going to cost. Give us a better idea of the price we're going to pay. That is the least we deserve, and it's the least our colleges should be required to provide. That is why I am urging you to support Senate File 2932 to ensure students have the information they need. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony and sharing your story. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next on our list is going to be Maddie Spartz, Policy and Research Analyst at Ed Allies. Welcome. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Chair Fateh and members, my name is Maddie Spartz, and I'm the Senior Policy and Research Analyst at Ed Allies. We're education advocates for students. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and share our support for Senate File 2932. The provisions in this bill would make the financial aid process clearer and more accessible for all Minnesota families. Thanks to this committee's leadership, Minnesota is expanding college and career options for its students, specifically via programs like North Star Promise and Direct Admissions. And this bill serves to bolster those efforts by helping students understand the financial realities of a college education. Anyone who has ever applied to college or helped a family member apply knows that financial aid letters are confusing, non-uniform, and difficult to interpret at best. For families without experience with college or financial aid terms, these letters can be even more intimidating. I began my career as a College Possible coach at Burnsville High School, and there I had, along with all the other coaches, dedicated curriculum teaching students how to interpret these letters because they are so complex and varied across institutions. And like the other testifier, we spent so much time just decoding what was in each letter, and that time would have been way better spent weighing the options, their benefits and drawbacks of their individual offers, what it would mean for their financial futures, and how to make the best decisions. A standardized financial aid letter, like the proposal in this bill, takes the onus off of students to interpret convoluted offer letters and requires colleges to present financial aid information in clear and uniform terms. And this would be especially impactful for students who don't have the support of a knowledgeable adult or peer to assist with them with such a critical decision. The choice of which college to attend or whether to attend at all reverberates throughout a student's entire life. And although it's just a piece of paper, the contents of a financial aid letter can quite literally make or break that student's future education, job prospects, financial well-being, and way more. Students and families deserve clear and digestible information to help inform this life-changing decision, and the provisions in this bill would ensure that happens. Under SF 2932, students and families won't need to interpret multiple complex financial aid letters, track down missing information in order to make a true comparison. By streamlining the financial aid letter process, we can help Minnesota students make well-informed decisions for their future. Thank you for your consideration of this bill, and thanks to Senator Uma Verbaeten for championing this important legislation.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up, we have Travis Matthews from Youth Prize. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee, for allowing me to testify today. My name is Travis Matthews, and I'm the Foster Postsecondary Coordinator at Youth Prize, and I help run the Foster Postsecondary Program or administer the Education Training Voucher, which provides financial support for those who are in foster care pursuing higher education, not to be confused with the Fostering Independence Grants. I'm here today to express support for SF 2932, which will create a standardized financial aid offer form to improve transparency and accessibility for students navigating the financial aid process. For many opportunity youth, especially those who have aged out of foster care, financial aid can mean the difference between pursuing higher education and foregoing it entirely. The ETV program offers up to $5,000 per year to eligible foster youth for college, vocational, and technical education, but one of the greatest challenges our students face is understanding how that aid fits into their broader financial picture, especially those who do not have other education programs that meet their cost of attendance, like the Fostering Independence Grants. Many of these students lack financial literacy skills and struggle to decipher complex, inconsistent, and unclear financial aid packages provided by different institutions. SF 2932 will address this challenge by ensuring Minnesota colleges and universities use a standardized financial aid form with clear student-friendly language. This will allow students to compare aid offers more easily, understand their costs, and make informed decisions about their education. Importantly, it will also help students distinguish between grants and scholarships and loans, preventing unnecessary debt and financial hardship down the road. I urge the committee to support SF-2932 to ensure that all students, especially those who have already faced significant barriers just getting to education, have the clarity they need to successfully pursue higher education and have successful outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Online, we have Bryce McKibben from Hope Center at Temple University. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Senator, and good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Bryce McKibben. As the Senior Director of Policy and Advocacy for the Hope Center for Student Basic Needs at Temple University, we're a national research center that focuses on the essential expenses that students must be able to meet in order to show up as full selves, as humans, and be successful in higher education, like food, housing, transportation, and healthcare. I'm very, very happy to testify in support of this bill to create standard financial aid offers because it responds to one of the most significant concerns that students and families face when they are trying to find a college or a workforce training option that works for them and that they can afford. And that is one that it allows that they can afford with the true cost, the real cost considered. Our data, national data, and surveys have time and time again confirmed that the cost of college is the number one concern of students and families. It's also the number one reason they consider or do drop out, but again, also the primary barrier for those who end up never going to college. And a huge part of this is that the process is, as you've heard today, incredibly opaque. It's often inconsistent, confusing, and in some cases, misleading. Now, the vast majority of financial aid officers and college staff, in my opinion, are doing incredible work, and they're doing it with very few resources, often overburdened and need additional help. But the colleges have their own way of and own unique way of doing things and incentives to differentiate themselves from other colleges. And they sometimes downplay the essential costs of living, like food and housing, that are nonetheless very, very real expenses for students in higher education. And the result is that there is a tremendous amount of variation between financial aid offers at each school. And even the most highly educated and experienced families who have multiple generations who've gone to college find it extremely difficult to understand what is in a financial aid offer, and to compare them. That's why this bill is very critical. It establishes some common sense treatment between terms of art and processes, but it also helps in particular students estimate and prepare for those costs of living that I keep mentioning, helping them avoid the types of basic needs and security related to food, housing, transportation, childcare, and healthcare when they get to campus. And by being able to prepare in advance, that makes them more likely to graduate once they get there. So as your committee considers this bill, I hope you will pass it. I also urge you to consider maybe adding some additional requirements within the bill to provide students with more information about public benefits and tax credits that could support them along their journey and support their financial security. But the bill really is already a great step. And I want to emphasize as the sponsor and as other testimony has offered that this is modeled after a very bipartisan piece of legislation. But in the opportunity to make Minnesota the first state to move forward with financial aid offer standardization, there really is a chance to make the state a standout leader for doing this type of work that is so urgently needed and so popular among our students and families. So I appreciate you hearing this legislation and for the opportunity to testify today, and I wish you the best of luck with the bill.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up, we have Eleanor Anderson, who's a student from St. Catharines University. Welcome, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Eleanor Anderson. I'm a junior at St. Catharines University, studying political science, public policy, and economics. I've always been a little bit of an overachiever who didn't know her limits. And in my senior year of high school, I applied to 11 colleges and universities around the country. I knew I wanted to study government, but I didn't know if I wanted a big school, small school, public or private, close to home, far away, you name it. I was fortunate enough to tour more than a dozen schools and ultimately decided to let financial aid determine my fate. I didn't rule out any institutions because of a high price tag, because people kept telling me that merit aid, scholarships, and loans could dramatically impact the sticker price. When March rolled around and every school released their admissions decisions and financial aid letters, which inexplicably do not come in the same email, I was at a loss for words. Not only did I still have no idea where I wanted to go to school, I had no idea how to compare costs. Some award letters included only the scholarships they were offering without any indication of how much I would still need to pay. Others included the cost of things like metro passes or expected textbook expenses and room and board. Some had subsidized and unsubsidized loans included as part of the offered aid, but most failed to indicate what money was being removed from my bill entirely and what I would be expected to pay back over time. To this day, and despite my parents' best efforts, I'm not sure how much it would have cost for me to attend the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. I received several acceptance letters, but there was no clear answer. It was incredibly disempowering, and I had no confidence in my ability to make an informed choice. I recognize that I am young and life is long, but my college application and admissions process was the most stressful period of my life, and you couldn't pay me money to go back. After everything, I transferred schools a semester in, partially because of unanticipated financial burdens. Society puts so much pressure on young people to make massive decisions about their futures, encouraging many to go to the best possible school they get into, without providing the information needed for young people to make responsible decisions. We encourage high schoolers to take personal finance classes and caution them to be wise about how many loans they take out in undergrad, while making it nearly impossible to know the true costs of higher education. This bill would help Minnesotans make more informed decisions about attending college and would require institutions to be transparent about the financial burden they're asking students and families to take on. The stress of college applications and higher ed should end with the admissions decision, not begin with committing years of your life and thousands of dollars after it's impossible to make adequate comparisons. Thank you for your time, and I encourage you to support Senate File 2932.
Thank you so much. Next online, we have John Runnigan, who's a student at Concordia University in Moorhead. Welcome. Thank you. Introduce yourself for the record and begin.
Thank you, Chair Fateh and members of the committee. My name is John Runnigan, and I'm a student at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, and I am a first-generation college student from rural Minnesota. I'm here today to urge you to support legislation that brings greater transparency and consistency to financial aid award letters. When I first received my financial aid letters, I expected them to clearly explain how much college would cost and what kind of support I was being offered. Instead, I was left confused and honestly pretty overwhelmed. The letter from Minnesota State University of Moorhead listed my scholarships and grants, but right alongside them were student loans, presented as if it were the same kind of aid. There was no mention that loans would have to be repaid or what the interest rates or terms were. At first glance, it looked like I was getting more help than I actually was. As someone who didn't grow up talking about financial aid or student loans at the dinner table, it took me a while to realize I was making decisions based on misleading information. The letter from Concordia College wasn't much better. While it was a bit clearer in some areas, it completely left out the Concordia Promise Scholarship, something I was counting on. I had to reach out to the registration office just to confirm I had received it and how much it would cover. For a scholarship that's advertised as a major piece of their financial aid package, that omission was surprising and frustrating. It made me feel like I was being left in the dark about my own financial future. These letters are supposed to help students make one of the most important decisions of our lives. But instead of clarity, I got confusion. Instead of transparency, I got mixed messages. And as a first-generation student trying to navigate college on my own, that lack of clear information felt like just another barrier stacked against me. This bill, SF2932, is about fairness. It's about making sure students and families get accurate, easy to understand information about what college will really cost. It's about separating loans from grants, clearly listing total cost, not just tuition, but books, transportation, and living expenses, and showing the actual net price that students will need to cover to get their education. This isn't just about policy, it's about dignity. It's about making sure every student, regardless of their background, can make informed decisions without being misled or left guessing. Please support Senate File 2932 and help bring clarity, consistency, and honesty to financial aid award letters. Students like me are counting on it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up, we have Haley Brown online from the Minnesota State College Southeast. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Fonte. Thank you, members of the committee. My name is Haley Brown, and I am currently a student at Minnesota State College Southeast in Red Wing, Minnesota, studying band instrument repair. And I am on track to graduate this upcoming May with hopes to find a job as a band instrument repair technician. I'm also currently the vice president of our student senate. I previously earned my undergraduate degree in music from the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, where I also worked in the financial aid office as a work-study student. In that role, I witnessed firsthand the confusion and frustration that students and their families face when trying to understand financial aid offers. For many students, especially those like me, who are first in their family to attend college, financial aid is one of the most confusing and stressful aspects of pursuing higher education. Working in financial aid, I regularly spoke with students who didn't understand what their aid packages meant. What was a loan versus a grant, how much they would actually need to pay out of pocket, or what their options were for covering remaining costs. Some students were shocked when they received their first tuition bill because they had misunderstood their aid offer, assuming that they owed less than they actually did. Financial aid is often the deciding factor in whether a student can afford to attend college, yet the way the information is presented is inconsistent, unclear, and at times misleading. In my experience working with students around financial aid, many often struggle to determine the actual cost of attending an institution after financial aid is applied. This lack of transparency can lead to students making life-altering financial decisions based on incomplete or misunderstood information. One of the biggest issues I've experienced is the inconsistency in how financial aid information is presented across institutions. Every school structures its aid offers differently. Some emphasize total cost, while others highlight the aid provided. And important details like loan terms or work-study eligibility might be buried in fine print. With this lack of clear and consistent information, students are left trying to decipher complex financial documents at a time where they should be focusing on their academic goals. Senate File 2932 takes a critical step towards addressing this problem by requiring all Minnesota institutions to adopt a standardized financial aid offer format. This will ensure that students receive clear and easy to understand information about their financial aid options, empowering them to make informed choices about where to enroll and how to finance their education. One of the most critical aspects of this bill is its requirement that schools provide a true cost breakdown of attendance. This includes both direct costs, such as tuition, fees, college-sponsored housing, and meal plans, as well as indirect costs, like books, supplies, transportation, and personal expenses. One of the biggest hurdles I ran across in my time working in financial aid was that many students do not realize that financial aid often does not cover these additional costs, leaving them scrambling to make up the difference once they're already enrolled. This is not just about convenience and standardization. It's about equity and access. By making aid offers clearer and more transparent, we can help level the playing field and ensure that every student, regardless of their background, has the knowledge they need to make the best financial decision for their future. With rising concerns about college affordability and student debt, we cannot afford to continue with the status quo. This bill is a solution that promotes clarity, fairness, and informed decision-making. As someone who has worked directly with students struggling to understand financial aid, I know how much this bill is needed. I'm grateful that this committee has brought this bill forward to support Minnesota students and families in understanding their financial options so that they can pursue and achieve higher education goals. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next up online, we have Mark Salisbury from Tuition Fit. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Fete and members of the committee. I'm Mark Salisbury. I've spent 25 years working in colleges and universities. My PhD is in studying how college impacts students and how consumers make decisions about post-secondary opportunities. In my years in higher education, I've worked in everything from athletics, admissions, financial aid, to institutional research. In 2018, I founded the Tuition Fit Project, really focused on a very specific goal, to make college prices truly transparent by enabling the public to crowdsource a single data set of financial aid offer letters and to be able to tell what the actual prices were. It was similar to what Edmunds did in the car industry or what Glassdoor did for individual salaries for specific positions at specific corporations. By crowdsourcing this data and anonymizing the offer letters, we were able to build now a data set that's over 30,000 offers from most colleges and universities in the U.S. And with each of those offers, we know something about the type of student that received that offer, mostly their financial need situation, their academic merit situation, and the state that they're from. From all of this data and this experience, I'd like to share a couple of thoughts and very much in support of SF 2932. Price transparency is prioritized even more by consumers than it ever has been, and ROI, as others have mentioned before, is and cost is the number one factor shaping decisions about post-secondary options. The financial aid offer, and really we're even using the language financial aid offer as a sort of proxy for what we would use a different word if we were talking about this in any other context. We would just talk about price. What's my price? I want to know what my price is going to be at whatever schools I might look at so that I can ensure that my price fits my financial situation, whatever that is. And financial aid offers, they run the gamut. Demonstrations of what your price might be run the gamut because they're offered by different offices on campuses. The admissions and recruiting office versus the financial aid office versus the business office and the bursar office, which, by the way, we might be the only people here who still know what a bursar actually is. The terminology issue is dramatically important, and others have already testified about how the terminology really is all over the map, and the financial aid offer letters really haven't changed, and there is a whole mechanism underneath dictating different choices about terminology and how you convey prices, scholarships, loans, plus loans, work study, not to mention scholarships that are only offered the first year and then vanish going into the second year, but no one tells the student that. So this couldn't be a more important piece of information to provide to students. One thing that hasn't been mentioned, and I think it's worth bringing to the committee, is price transparency certainly is critical for the public. But price transparency is also really important for higher education institutions themselves, public and private institutions. The lack of price transparency over the past several decades has given fuel to the fire of the narrative that all college is too expensive. And if you look at just sticker prices, that's what anybody would think. But the reality is the actual prices that students pay vary considerably and can go from literally nothing all the way to now $105,000 a year for 1 year of college. And the prices are literally anywhere in between there. And because of that lack of transparency and that belief amongst the public, one thing we don't have enough data on, but is very clear from those of us who work in this space, is the number of folks who, by the time their students in ninth grade have already decided that college is simply unaffordable, and they simply choose never to bother to even look, and they choose different academic paths in high school because there's no point in being academically prepared to go to college because I can't afford it anyway. Colleges and universities desperately need to have a reset happen for them writ large so that their actual prices are clear to the public and the public starts to see a different reality. It doesn't mean that we don't have an affordability problem for some people going to college. We certainly do. But it also means that we ought to be able to have a little bit clearer sense of which options fit which individuals' financial situations and goals so that the public can make more informed decisions. And that leads to the second piece of this, which I want to add because I think it is an important piece of the puzzle here. The public is wonderfully happy about the possibility of price transparency. but the public is particularly underwhelmed about finding out their actual price at the very end of a year-long process that involves narrowing down your list of colleges, selecting a small number to apply to, waiting to get accepted, and then finding out your prices. And so many families, as one testified earlier today, find out at that point that their price is what their offers are, and had they known, might very well have chosen a different school to apply to in the first place. Didn't know until the end. It seems that that is also a piece of the puzzle that probably needs to be addressed. But the only way to start is by providing price transparency to the public. One other thing to add. While the legislation here is...
Mr. Salisbury?
Yes.
Sorry about that. We need to go to the next testifier, so if you can wrap up your comments, I appreciate it. Thank you so
much. Absolutely. The college financing plan is a template provided by the Department of Education. It's been around for almost a decade. It already solves some of these questions, and it is available to colleges and universities. In fact, institutions already, many of them are already required to be able to provide it. So institutions and colleges that say this is just too difficult to do, they're already actually doing this. They're just not required to provide it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Lastly, we have Mike Dean, Executive Director from the North Star Prosperity. Welcome back.
Great. Thank you very much, Chair Fateh and members of the committee. My name is Mike Dean. I'm the Executive Director of North Star Prosperity, an organization committed to expanding opportunities for every Minnesotan to achieve their economic freedom and a meaningful future. My journey to college was anything but straightforward. Growing up in Lake Elmo, Minnesota, I learned early on that higher education was often seen as a privilege rather than a right. I remember distinctly in 11th grade, my parents sat me down and told me they couldn't afford to pay for college. In that moment, I realized I was stepping into a system that wasn't built for transparency or accessibility. Like so many others, I found myself staring down the rising cost of tuition, trying to make sense of financial aid offers that seemed designed more to confuse rather than inform. But I was fortunate. I started a landscaping business that allowed me to cover my tuition and living expenses, graduating without student debt. But luck and entrepreneurship should not be a prerequisite for access to higher education. Now, more than 30 years later, I face a familiar challenge. How do I help my own children afford college? And what worries me the most as a father is not just the cost, but it's this lack of clarity in financial aid award letters that are supposed to guide students and families through this critical decision. And this problem is not unique to me. I think just last 2 weeks ago, Senator Dreheim was before this committee raising this very issue with concerns about misleading and inconsistent nature of these financial aid award letters. And his concerns are backed up by that 2022 Government Accountability Report, which Senator Omer Verbane talked about before. And I just want to take a moment to thank the senator for her work on this. She's done a phenomenal job reaching out to advocates, engaging the higher ed institutions, and then really centering this work around students to make sure that we have a bill that's palatable, that will work for the institutions, but most importantly, brings transparency really to this process. And so with that, we've reviewed the bill, and we've actually created a mock-up of what a financial aid offer letter could and should look like. And if you look at this compared to maybe your own offer letter, what other institutions have put together, this is a much clearer way, and I think would have a huge positive impact for families to really understand what's going on, whether things are loans or grants, and then the full cost of this expense. Because we heard earlier from the students about how challenging this whole experience has been, and they are just making sometimes poor decisions because they don't have critical information around this. And I think I want to echo what Senator Omer Verbane said earlier, and that is this is a really key consumer protection issue. It doesn't cost the institutions much, but it's going to help students make really some important decisions. Now, some institutions may call this an unfunded mandate, but really believe that transparency is not a burden. It's really a fundamental consumer protection. Students and families deserve to know the true cost of college so that they can make those informed financial decisions. And right now, too many choices are based on incomplete and misleading information, leading to unnecessary debt and financial hardship. Senate File 2932 would hold institutions accountable for providing honest, standardized, accurate financial information and empowering students and families with the knowledge they need to succeed. This issue is personal to me as a parent, and it's to thousands of parents across the state of Minnesota. And we have an opportunity to remove a major barrier to higher education and to ensure financial aid letters empower rather than mislead. And I urge you to support Senate File 2932 and give Minnesota students and families the transparency they so deserve.
Thank you so much, Mr. Dean, for your testimony. Our first question is from Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first question, I'm wondering if there is a fiscal note on this bill, because I do not see one in the packet.
Ms. Birch.
Chair Fate, Senator Rarick, a fiscal note has been requested and assigned to Commerce, Minnesota State, the Department of Education, the Office of Higher Education, and the University of Minnesota, but it's not yet complete. So as soon as it is, we can circulate it.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess probably have some questions for Senator Umu-Verbaeten. I guess what we haven't been hearing around this bill in any of the testimony is how this is going to be implemented and come together. And so I'm just wondering, being OHE did not testify about their ability to meet these timelines, has that discussion been happening around the dates that you've put in here, specifically looking at after they get their first draft of it, the September 1st, 2026, and they're supposed to solicit feedback. Will there be a second round of feedback? Will that be ongoing? And will there be time from that point to have it the document ready to our institutions and be able to have them put that out in time for that 27-28 school year, being students are making those decisions a lot of times in the spring?
Thanks, Senator Rick. I think we can call up Dr. Robinson.
And Mr. Chair, just while Dr. Robinson is on way up, I would say one important piece of feedback from institutions was just around that start date. So moving that back to the 2028-2029 school year. So it's been part of the conversation.
Thank you. And welcome, Dr. Robinson. Please introduce yourself and you may respond.
Sure. Thank you. Hi, my name is Wendy Robinson. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Programs, Policies, and Grants at the Office of Higher Education. And I would say, generally, anytime that we have a working group process that's involving stakeholder consultation, kind of our best practice would be to start at the end and figure out from the time that there's a draft completed, what would be the implementation timeline for the institutions to update, to work with their technology vendors to update the fields that they would need to update to get that ready to go and aligned with their admissions and financial aid cycles. So I think we would look at that, and I think having the deadline pushed out farther would certainly give more time for that process, that sort of iterative process, to be able to happen.
Senator Rarick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Another question. I know a lot of times we put together stakeholder groups like we saw in the last bill. This one doesn't get to that far. It's just asking you to reach out to stakeholders. Do you, the way this is put together, asking you to reach out to them, do you prefer kind of that process to give you that ability, or are there group, I mean, is there around that, has there been discussion around that, keeping it open for the agency to be able to work with, or are there things that we feel should be added for folks who should be involved in this process?
Dr. Robinson.
Thank you, Chair Fontaine and Senator Rarick. So obviously this is not an OHE-authored bill, and we are officially neutral on the subject of the bill. I would say, in general, having some flexibility in terms of developing a working group can be helpful. I think we do have a really well-established practice of working with financial aid stakeholders. We have a financial aid advisory group. We have, because of our relationships through state grant and state financial aid programs, we kind of have a network of folks that we would identify as the representatives that we would need to have. I think if we're looking at an opportunity for a letter that would cross institutional types, and we would make sure that we would have representation from across institutional types as well. And so I would say I think we are pretty comfortable and pretty experienced with putting together cross-functional and cross-agency working groups. So I think we can make it work either way.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last, this isn't a question. It's just something that I see in this bill. We've had it in many others. On page two, where we are saying the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota is requested to comply with this section. Mr. Chair, we've had this conversation many times. We continue to hear from the university that, you know, they're a land-grant institution that came about before us, and we can't put any requirements on them. Like, my opinion continues to be the same. There is no, they do not have to take students that are taking grants from the state of Minnesota. And so if they're going to, I do not understand why we cannot require them to do this same thing. It has been something that, I get it. I believe that is meant to say, if we're giving them money for operations, we can't dictate to them exactly how it is to be used. But this is something that if they're going to accept students who are getting financial aid from the state of Minnesota, we absolutely should be able to require them to follow certain guidelines that we're putting on every other institution in this state. So I think that's something we have to consider as this goes forward. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rarick. Any other members with questions or comments? Seeing none, Senator Mulverbane, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we heard a lot of really great testimony. Appreciate the comments. Look forward to continuing to work with all the stakeholders on this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Mulverbane. And with that, Senate file 2932, as amended, is laid over. With that, we are adjourned.